Water, Wisconsin, and the Mercury Cycle, a production of the University of Wisconsin Water Resources Institute, with funding provided by the United States Geological Survey. In attempting to develop a nuanced understanding of the Mercury Cycle and its effects, it is reasonable to ask, why do people use mercury if it is known to be toxic, and how did its use become so pervasive? These are good questions, and they will be addressed in this episode, Mercury, the Potent Element.
The hottest, the coldest, a true healer, a wicked murderer, a precious medicine, and a deadly poison. A friend that can flatter and lie.
Englishman John Woodall used these words to describe mercury in his 1639 book, The Surgeon's Mate. In many ways, humanity's perception of the element known as mercury is much the same today. Its flexible properties are still being employed in novel and constructive ways, yet usage of this metal entails levels of precaution, comprehension, and vigilance that make challenging demands on scientific expertise. Still, notwithstanding the passionate descriptions of Woodall, mercury has always been a part of the natural world, and this episode will trace its history and use up to present times. Geologists believe that the metals found on our planet's surface did not all originate simultaneously when the Earth formed roughly 5 billion years ago. Igneous rock formed by magma solidified first. This layer contains metals such as nickel, tin, and platinum. Ores containing metals like iron or mercury are found in relatively younger sedimentary rock. Traces of mercury can be found virtually everywhere on the globe, depending on the sensitivity of the measuring instruments, but it is rarely found in concentration, and then usually in the form of a red ore known as cinnabar. Minute quantities of mercury naturally circulate in the environment, and all organisms alive today are adapted to its presence. However, human actions can greatly affect the amount of mercury distributed through the Earth's air and waters, and this substance has been a part of human productivity for a very long time. Cinnabar, the mineral form of mercury sulfide found in nature, has been put to ornamental use in human cultures since prehistoric times. Found in Neolithic sites such as Çatalhöyük in Turkey and ancient Jericho in the Mideast, where it was applied to decorated skulls, it has also been discovered in archaic burial sites in Spain and Italy, where it was apparently used to preserve human bones. Cinnabar was employed extensively to formulate pigments all over the ancient world, in India, the Mediterranean, Central America, and most notably in China, where it was used to create a distinctive red ink for official seals and documents. Known as vermilion, this color, eventually perfected in the 8th century Common Era through a synthesis of mercury ore and sulfur, is the brilliant red that can be seen on European illuminated manuscripts and in traditional Chinese art. By analyzing human bones and lake sediment cores for traces of mercury, mercury mines have been confirmed to have been in operation at least 3,500 years ago at the ancient Hittite town of Iconium, modern-day Konya in Turkey, and near Huancavelica, Peru, located southeast of Lima. Exactly how and when people first learned to distill mercury by heating cinnabar ore in air and collecting the condensation is not known. However, definitive accounts of the use of metallic mercury are found in the works of early Greeks and Romans. Mercury is the only metal that exists as a liquid at room temperature and held a great mystique to those who first refined it. Aristotle, writing in the 4th century before the Common Era, refers to a liquid silver, Argyros Chytos, in his Meteorology. His pupil, Theophrastus, uses the same term in De Lapidis, the oldest known book on mineralogy. Later Roman writers, such as Pliny the Elder and Strabo, all mention hydrargyrum, or quicksilver, the Latinized version of this Greek term. The Romans prized mercury for its ability to make amalgams, substances formed by the reaction of another substance. Most metals can form amalgams with mercury, though platinum and iron cannot. Mercury allows for the collection of very small particles of metal. These malleable alloys remain important in dentistry, and the gold-mercury amalgam process continues to be used to extract gold from ore today. The Romans established an extensive and profitable trade in minium, their name for cinnabar ore. Even then, the ancients were keenly aware of the dangers involved in its extraction and the production of the mercury. Though large cinnabar mines were maintained by the Romans in Almudaine, Spain, an area that recycles mercury today, Tacitus noted that mining was banned from anywhere near Rome due to its adverse effects on the environment. However, in the centuries following the Roman Empire, despite this known toxicity, quicksilver became the focus of interest and study for a new and very different type of research. Like early miners and metallurgists, the first alchemists were also intrigued by quicksilver's shape-shifting abilities. By the 7th century Common Era, and probably much earlier, they were using the name mercury to describe this remarkable metal. These magicians-slash-chemists-slash-mystics associated its volatile traits with the swift messenger god Mercury, who already had a planet bearing his name. As these alchemists were equally fascinated with astrology, the planetary symbol of Mercury became inexorably linked to the element as well. In alchemical thought, great significance was placed on the so-called tria prima of Mercury, sulfur, and salt. These transmutable materials were powerful and mysterious, and the alchemists strove to use them to obtain power over nature and to change base metals into gold. In their records, they would often use fanciful terms for mercury, such as doorkeeper, bird of Hermes, and venomous dragon, in order to hide their alchemical secrets from uninitiated eyes. Such interest in mercury was not limited to the West. Quicksilver played a dominant role in alchemy in China, the Mideast, and especially in India, where it was referred to as rasa, or vital fluid. Mercury was the centerpiece of alchemical practice, as it was thought to be the seed of the god Shiva himself. This may account for some of the strange tantric recipes that have survived to this day.
Take a gold leaf 3 niskas in weight, and quicksilver 9 niskas. And rub them with acids for 3 hours. Make the amalgam into a phallus, emblem of Shiva, the creative principle. By the mere sight of the phallus of Mercury, the sins accumulated by the killing of 1,000 Brahmins and 10,000 cows are redeemed.
Alchemy spread throughout the civilized world from the 4th century to the 16th century, and its strange mixture of knowledge and superstition typified the use and understanding of mercury before the rise of modern science. It wasn't until the 1500s that European alchemists were finally able to turn mercury into gold, though in a more indirect way. A new and fearsome disease, syphilis, spread throughout Europe, and desperate sufferers demanded relief. Portuguese sailors returning from India brought back knowledge of powerful mercurial medicines. Alchemists such as Paracelsus recommended vigorous courses of mercury to be taken internally, applied in ointments, or absorbed in sweatbox baths. These mercury treatments certainly enriched the practitioners, but the well-being of their patients was decidedly more problematic. We know now that mercury is highly toxic to living organisms, but what began then may be one of the most colossal misfirings of medical practice in the history of medicine. At its roots is a basic logical fallacy of correlation proving causation, when two events that occur together are claimed to have a cause and effect relationship. The thinking works like this. 1. Patients presumed to have syphilis were treated with mercury. 2. Some of the patients recovered or appeared to recover. 3. Therefore, mercury cured syphilis. Though numerous level-headed observers raised objections to these mercurial treatments over the years, mercury was to remain a primary weapon of Western pharmacology until well into the 20th century. And was used to combat a host of ailments. Mercury does have antiseptic and purgative properties. However, the therapies usually prescribed involved administration of mercury compounds over extended periods of time, leading to toxicity as it accumulated in the human body. During the lengthy course of treatment, many of the hapless patients recovered anyway, leading the doctors to attribute healing power to their concoctions. Even so, many patients became far sicker than they would have been without any such remedies, and indeed, many must have died due to their medicine. One of the most infamous cases of this occurred when the well-respected physician and signer of the Declaration of Independence, Benjamin Rush, used large doses of calomel in an attempt to stop a virulent outbreak of yellow fever in the city of Philadelphia in 1793. Calomel was the name for the compound mercury chloride, a white odorless solid that was popularly used in the pharmacology of the times. Mercury chloride has low solubility in water, which prevents it from being as absorbed as readily into the body as other forms of mercury, reducing its toxicity somewhat. When a few patients survived after receiving Rush's cure, he went on a heroic and misguided quest to stop the disease in Philadelphia. He administered calomel to patients in such prodigious amounts that sometimes their hair and teeth fell out. Eventually, he was questioned about his drastic measures and enthusiasm for mercury treatments.
Dr. Rush, in that emphatical style which is peculiar to himself, calls mercury the Samson of medicine. In his hands, and those of his partisans, it may indeed be justly compared to Samson, for I verily believe they have slain more Americans with it than ever Samson slew of the Philistines. The Israelite slew his thousands, but the Rushites have slain their tens of thousands. William Cobbett, journalist, 1797.
The good doctor was not alone in his efforts. Mercury was a common ingredient in 19th century patent medicines. Abraham Lincoln himself was known to have taken blue mass, little blue pills containing mercury, in the period leading up to his presidency, and was famous for towering rages and bizarre erratic behavior during this time. Fortunately for the country, he ceased taking them in 1861. Calomel continued to be used in teething powders into the 20th century, primarily in the United Kingdom, and babies regularly sickened with what was called pink disease until it was eventually recognized as mercurial poisoning in the 1950s. While medicine continued to fumble in the dark with its mercuric potions, by the 17th century, proto-chemists were beginning to make significant advances in actually comprehending the elements. When Robert Boyle published The Skeptical Chemist in 1661, he set in motion the systematic displacement of medieval alchemy by modern chemistry. Though Boyle himself straddled a peculiar line between alchemy and chemistry, he used mercury in experiments that proved his theory that states that at constant temperatures, the volume of a confined gas is inversely proportional to the pressure. This became known as Boyle's Law. Mercury vaporizes easily, and throughout the 18th century, quicksilver continued to play a critical part in advancing the knowledge of gases such as oxygen, of which very little was known previously. Because mercury expands and contracts evenly with changes in temperature, it was also integral to the development of early thermometers and barometers. Mercury was placed on Antoine Lavoisier's initial Table of Substances in 1789, and it was formally listed as the element Hg, after the original Greek term hydrargyrum in Dmitri Mendeleev's periodic table in 1869. Mercury is very dense, over 13 times denser than water. The periodic table is organized around atomic weight, so mercury takes its current position low on the chart as element number 80. The scientific definition of an element is defined as a pure substance that cannot be broken down into any smaller substances by chemical methods. It is these defining properties of elemental mercury that made it so appealing to both chemists and industrial pioneers in the 19th and 20th centuries, and so challenging to deal with today. A final property of mercury that brings its history into modern times is its high electrical conductivity. Electrical manufacturers have used mercury in the production of vapor lamps, switches, relays, and batteries. Surpassing these products in the 20th century, however, was the chloralkali industry, which produced chlorine by sending an electrical charge through brine collected on top of sheets of mercury, the so-called mercury cells. Though dangerous to handle, mercury's conductivity was very advantageous for many industrial practices, and use of mercury continued to expand in the 20th century, exploding after World War II. It was even found in paints and insecticides up to the 1970s, and was still being casually used in trinkets and glow-when-you-step tennis shoes into the 1980s. But starting in the mid-20th century, the alarms that had regularly sounded about the use of mercury began to reach a horrifying crescendo. that there was a serious occupational risk in handling cinnabar and mercury had been recognized since ancient times. In 1473, in what was possibly the first book on industrial hygiene, Ulrich Ellenbog wrote this about the effects of mercury on goldsmiths in Germany at that time.
Dieser Dampf von Quecksilber ist Silber.
This vapor of quicksilver, silver and lead is a cold poison, for it makes heaviness and tightness of the chest, burdens the limbs, and oftentimes lames them, as one often sees in foundries where men work with metals.
Later 16th century writers, such as Agricola and the alchemist Paracelsus, were well aware of mercurial poisoning, describing such well-known symptoms as tremors, psychic disturbance, and loss of teeth. And those who worked around quicksilver mines in Spain in the New World knew of the dangers involved in its extraction. One famous Frenchman commented wryly in the mid-1700s of the cost and benefits of the Spanish mercury mine at Almadén.
It brings the king nearly £2 million every year and ruin to many men. Diderot.
The primary treatise on occupational medicine in the 18th century, however, was Bernardino Ramazzini's De Morbis Artificum Diatriba, Diseases of Workers, which described the health risks encountered in 52 different occupations. He noted the pathologies associated with mine workers, as well as with doctors and chemists who handled mercury. He even questioned whether Paracelsus, known for his irregular behavior, may himself have had mercury poisoning. Mirror makers, gilders, and smiths all faced risks of mercury exposure in previous times. In the 19th century, another industry began using a form of mercury, which led to what might be the most well-known case of alleged mercury poisoning.
Maybe I'll meet someone kind enough to help me.
Oh. Well, in that direction, there's a hatter. And in that direction, there's a March Hare. Visit either you like. They're both mad.
Lewis Carroll's Mad Hatter character from Alice in Wonderland is often said to have gone mad from mercury poisoning, but that is probably not the real story. Though mercuric nitrate was used in the manufacture of felt for hats, it separates the fur from the pelt and mats it together, and long-term exposure is an occupational hazard, the hatter was more likely inspired by an unusual furniture dealer named Theophilus Carter, known for always wearing a top hat and being obsessed with time. He even invented an alarm clock bed that woke the sleeper by tipping him off the mattress. Carroll, in all probability, saw this at the Great Exhibition in London in 1851. He reportedly sent his illustrator, Sir John Tenniel, to Oxford to sketch Carter for the memorable images used in the original Alice publication. In any case, the hatter in the story does not display the usual signs of mercurialism observed in hat makers, outside of a certain erraticism typical of all the characters in the story. That real-life hatters faced severe risks of mercury poisoning was being reported as early as 1860. It was only after two major studies were made of the felt hat industry by the U.S. Public Health Service in the 1930s that the use of nitrate of mercury was finally banned in hat manufacture on December 1, 1941. In most countries around the world by the mid-20th century, mercury was being increasingly regulated as its hazardous potential was becoming more widely understood. However, the turning point in public awareness of the dangers of mercury can be traced to Japan in the 1950s. The Chiso Corporation opened a chemical factory in Minamata in 1908 and had been dumping wastewater into Minamata Bay for years. Residents from nearby fishing villages who ate mercury-contaminated fish and shellfish had begun suffering from the effects of mercury poisoning, including birth defects. Locally, it was called Minamata disease. For a long time, its root causes were not understood. But by the late 1950s and early 1960s, it was becoming apparent that mercury poisoning was responsible, and hundreds of people were being affected. The company fought the charges, and a protracted legal struggle ensued. Ultimately, it was disturbing photographs of the Japanese victims of mercury poisoning, many of them children, taken by W.E. Smith and published in Life magazine in 1972, that brought worldwide attention to the dangers of mercury contamination. Since that time, momentum has slowly and sometimes fitfully gathered to identify, curb, and eventually eliminate industrial processes that introduce mercury into the environment. And that leads to the next part of our story. Water, Wisconsin, and the Mercury Cycle is a production of the Water Resources Institute with funding provided by the United States Geological Survey. This podcast was written and recorded by Chris Bocast. That's me. Other voices appearing were Buzz Kemper, John Carl, and Stefan Westerhoff. I also wrote and performed the music, except for The Queen's Dolor, which was written by Henry Purcell way back when in merry old England. The sitar, which was written and performed by Cahoe and used through Creative Commons license. And Gary Owen, which was performed by the 82nd Airborne Division's band. That piece and this podcast are both public domain. Thanks for listening.